This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. As you may already know, World Oceans Day is celebrated on the 8th of June every year. Covering 71% of the Earth's surface, the oceans have been dubbed a gold mine for medical research and possibilities. Here on Health and Living, we're choosing to celebrate the ocean's diversity by looking at all the ways in which the ocean has enriched our health and medicine. Later in the show, I'll be speaking to Dr. Yusrizam Sharifuddin from the Institute of Biological Sciences at the Science Faculty of University Malaya on diabetes fighters found in seaweed, as well as Professor Pang Siu Moy on astaxanthin, a powerful antioxidant derived from microalgae. We gather their thoughts on how these compounds are isolated, as well as the possibilities and stumbling blocks health research in the oceans face. But first up, Dr. Chai Sun Tai from University Tunku Abdul Rahman explains what it means to search the oceans for life-saving medicines and explains his own work with sponges. Dr. Chai, hundreds of thousands of species live in the oceans. How does one know where to start looking for potential pharmaceutical compounds?
What happens is that different researchers or different research groups, they usually use different strategies. So for some of the researchers, they might start off with literature search, and then based on knowledge on related species, they will decide on, okay, what are the potential species to work on. So what that means is, okay, based on the literature search, they look up a lot of published papers, and they know that, okay, certain species, certain sponges or certain coral species, they might be important pharmaceutical compounds have been isolated from them. So they will know that, okay, this group is promising, and therefore they will start focusing all their effort on this group of species. But on the other hand, there are other researchers who might just carry out their research based on folks' knowledge on certain marine animals or plants. One example would be sea cucumber. So people know that sea cucumber has some medicinal value, and therefore they might want to work on sea cucumber, different species of sea cucumber, and then try to see what kind of pharmaceutical compounds they can isolate from there. Another approach that has been used by some of the researchers would be what I would call like ecology or geography guided search. So basically what this means is that they might be want to look in places that are quite unique, like somewhere under the Antarctic ice or underwater volcanoes, for example. And whatever it is, a lot of times is what researchers are doing is that search will be more like guided search instead of the random search.
Dr. Chai, the ocean has been described as the next frontier for medical research. Do you think that there is still a lot of bioprospecting to be done, a lot of compounds to be discovered?
Yes. Well, one thing about this is that from time to time, some research institutions or universities or some countries, they will launch some marine explorations, and then they will come back telling us that they discovered new biodiversity hotspots or new species, new organisms, and so on. So what this means is that there are still a lot of biodiversity resources that we can exploit from the marine environment. That's what I believe.
How do bioprospectors screen through the many organisms that they find when they go out to look?
From what I understand, usually, so when they come back to the lab with all the samples, okay, they will usually have in mind already what kind of tests or assays, okay, what kind of tests that they want to carry out. So they will usually start with relatively simple biochemical or cell-based tests or assays to allow them to screen the large number of samples that they have and in a relatively short time. So for the objective of discovering some potential anti-cancer drugs, for example, they will carry out tests on cancer cell lines, on cancer cells. they will do some extraction work on the samples that they have carried out. For example, for sponge, they might use some organic solvents and then extract some compounds from the sponges, and then take those compounds and then put it onto the cancer cells and see whether the cancer cells will stop growing or they will grow slower or they are not affected at all. So based on that, they will be able to narrow down the types of which are the samples that they can carry to the next step or the next phase of their screening. Yep.
You work on obtaining pharmaceutical compounds from sponges. Why sponges?
Okay. Sponges, they have been described as the chemical factories of the oceans. So there have been quite a number of successful discoveries of potential drugs and actually some marketed drugs, okay, that can be traced back to sponges. So one of the examples that I can give you here is a drug called eribulin, which is used as an anti-cancer treatment for breast cancers. It actually comes from a sponge called helichondria. So the eribulin is actually the synthetic version, the synthesized version of a compound that was extracted from the helichondria sponge. Besides this example, there are quite a number of other sponge-derived bioactive compounds that are currently undergoing different phases of clinical and preclinical trials. So in other words, sponges, they are, you can think of it as a gold mine for the bioprospectors, I guess.
And discodamolide is an example of pharmaceutical compound derived from sponges. What is it?
It's an organic compound that is really good in preventing the cancer cells from dividing. So from what I know at the moment, it's still going through the clinical trials and trying to clear the clinical trials. Yep.
Okay. And how does discodamolide work?
So actually what happens is that it will bind to the skeletons of the cancer cells and stop them from developing or expanding further, and therefore the cancer cells, they will basically be just frozen in or arrested in their development, and they won't expand or divide anymore. So after some time, the cancer cells will slowly die.
So speaking broadly, when we have a sponge, for example, and we're looking to extract a compound from it, what is the process that you would have to go through?
You start with the samples of sponges that you collected from the ocean, for example. From there, depending on what kind of compounds that you try to get from the sponges, you will use different techniques to extract them. So a lot of times, what people would use would be some kind of organic solvents, ethanol, acetone, for example, to extract the compounds from the sponges. And then from there, they would do many rounds of purification to get rid of all the irrelevant compounds from there so that they get something purer and more potent.
What is the difference between using compounds extracted from organic structures as opposed to synthesizing them?
Usually what happens in the course of drug development is that a lot of time we start with a compound that we could extract from sponges or other marine organisms. And then from there, the chemists, okay, will be doing their magic and try to synthesize to produce a synthetic version, which they can use all kind of techniques to modify or change the structure to increase the potency or increase the activity of the compound. One important benefit or advantage about doing the synthetic version is that it might be expensive, but you can synthesize or produce a lot of them. So an example would be, okay, discodamolide, we were talking about that. So to extract discodamolide, you probably need 1 ton of sponge, and you will get less than 1 gram of discodamolide. So what has been done by private company in Switzerland and some scientists in the US, if I'm not mistaken, is that they carry out the synthesis. They try to synthesize it in the lab so that you don't have to always head out to the sea to get the to get tons of sponge to extract just a little bit of the active compound. Yep.
And what other pharmaceutical compounds might we find in, you know, sponges, our gold mine, our chemical factory of the sea?
Okay, at this point, can I talk a little bit about my research?
Yes.
Well, it's actually relevant to your questions. In my research group, we were trying to look at bioactive peptides from sponges. Okay, so the bioactive peptides, basically you can think of them as fragments of proteins. So in other words, we are trying to take the proteins from sponges, chop them up into pieces, into fragments, and then try to find out which of the fragments actually have some kind of useful therapeutic properties. Research that has been carried out by scientists everywhere, they have shown that the bioactive peptides of sponges and other marine lives, they are very good sources of a lot of therapeutic agents or potential therapeutic agents. So far, they have been shown to the peptides from the marine life, they have been shown to have anti-cancer, antibacterial, anti-hypertension activities, for example. And the marine life, okay, that scientists work on to extract these useful fragments of proteins or peptides are not just limited to sponges. It can be something that is edible, like all the fishes, or something non-edible, like seafood processing waste or sponge, for example, or some of the non-edible algae, soft corals, and so on. So all these are good sources of proteins, that marine proteins that can be chopped up into pieces, and then the lab scientists will go and search for the active peptides with the therapeutically relevant properties.
So looking at this process, how long does it take to find and test pharmaceutical products derived from sponges and then commercialize it?
I think it depends. It's on a case-by-case basis, I guess. Like in the case of urobilin, it was actually isolated by scientists, Japanese scientists, from the sponge in around 1986. And then in 2010, okay, it was approved as an anti-cancer therapy. So it took about, 24 years. But in the case of discodumolai, if I'm not mistaken, is this still not approved to be marketed as an anti-cancer drug, even though it was also first isolated from the sponge around 1990. So in one case, it takes 24, 30 years. In another case, nothing marketable come out of it yet.
But the research is, in a way, what's important, right? The idea that we can find useful medical compounds in the sea.
Yeah, yes, it is.
And what message would you like to leave us with for World Oceans Day?
I guess it's fair to say that the ocean itself is really like a goldmine for bioprospecting research. And all those bioprospecting research, as has been shown by a lot of the successfully marketed anti-cancer drugs, it tells us that something from the oceans, resources from the ocean, can actually save life. And therefore, it is the conservation of the marine ecosystem is really important.
That was Dr. Chai Sun Tai from University Tunku Abdul Rahman. Next, we'll be hearing from Dr. Yusrizam Sharifuddin from University Malaya on anti-diabetic compounds found in seaweed. But first, Bobby Darin with Beyond the Sea, BFM 89.9.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, speaking today to Dr. Yusrizam Sharifuddin from the Institute of Biological Sciences at the Science Faculty of University of Malaya. We're exploring what the ocean has to offer us in terms of health and medicine. And today, Dr. Yusrizam will be talking about one aspect of that. So firstly, what is diabetes? The reason for why we're talking about this will become clear soon.
Hello. Thank you for having me. First and foremost, diabetes mellitus is a group of chronic diseases which can be attributed to hyperglycemia, which is a condition characterized by an excessive concentration of glucose circulating in the blood. And diabetes is also frequently correlated with increased risk in hypertension, microvascular and also microvascular complications. And the numbers of sufferers are increasing worldwide, including in Malaysia.
More than 1.2 million Malaysians, or 4% of our population, has diabetes. What treatments do we have right now for this disease?
Okay, first and foremost, I'm not a physician, but there are various treatments available for diabetic sufferers, depending on the treatment objectives. We all know that diabetics have to take periodic insulin injection to help the body use or store the glucose it gets from food. Hence, keeping their blood glucose level low is crucial. So other diabetic medications which are commercially available, especially for type 2 diabetes, include alpha-glucosidase inhibitors such as Acarbose. Acarbose slows down carbohydrate digestion. And then we have sulfonylureas, which stimulates the production of insulin by the pancreas, and bigonides such as metformin, which prevents the production of glucose in the liver. These are to name a few. So there's plenty of medication for diabetic sufferers.
You've been working on extracting compounds from seaweeds with anti-diabetic function. Why did you start looking for medical compounds in seaweed?
Yeah, okay. The idea first came from Professor Pang Siew Moy when she invited me to join a collaborative research effort between University of Malaya and Queen's University Belfast. I know I would be in good hands considering that IUS has ample expertise in seaweed research, especially working with Prof Pang. And my UM collaborator for this project includes Dr. Lim, and together we supervise Mr. Chin Yajan, who is a currently UM PhD candidate. I never worked with seaweeds before, but over the course of time and doing research, I became a firm believer in their unique qualities and potential. For example, there are more nutrients, vitamins and other compounds that can be found in seaweeds compared to their terrestrial counterparts. There is strong research effort on the utilization of seaweeds for medical applications, and this is not limited to diabetes. They can also be anti-cancer, antioxidant, anti-cholesterol, and so on and so forth. And over the years, we've seen increasing number of publications, especially from East Asian countries, documenting the benefits of seaweeds in managing diabetes.
You mentioned there the difference between seaweed and their terrestrial counterparts. Could you take us through that from a scientific perspective? Because I think for most of us, you know, the idea of there being a difference is obvious, but we don't necessarily know what makes seaweed so particularly, you know, nutrient dense, or what makes it biologically different.
Well, we can see from, for example, fiber content and also certain vitamins. From the literature and also from our work, we noticed that some of these compounds, and especially for fiber, when you compare weight per weight compared to their terrestrial counterparts, you can get more from seaweed.
And what seaweeds in particular have you been looking at, and where can they be found?
Okay, we look at several species. These include Halimeda, Sargassum, Colerpa, Padaina, and Laurentia, to name a few. They can be found in various locations in Malaysia, including west and east coast of the peninsula, as well as in the east coast of Sabah.
And what are the compounds that you've isolated?
Well, several potential compounds have been identified from the selected seaweed species mentioned before, and more work is currently being conducted on these promising candidates. However, we cannot disclose their identities yet prior to scientific publication, but suffice to say that we are pleasantly surprised with the results obtained so far.
How would they help a diabetes patient?
Okay. Generally, they will assist diabetes patients through glycemic control. That is, controlling the blood sugar levels, and in our body, in our study, for example, we concentrate on controlling postprandial hyperglycemia, which is high sugar concentration after meals.
We understand what it takes to get diabetes under control. How do these compounds contribute towards that, speaking generally?
Okay. Well, for our study, we look at three main properties of the antidiabetic activities possessed by these different seaweed compounds. The first is we look at their potential to inhibit alpha-glucosidase enzyme activity. Now, this group of enzymes are involved in digestion of carbohydrates, especially after meal, and abrupt post-meal elevation of blood glucose concentration is due to the digestion of carbohydrates. Therefore, if we can inhibit the activity of this enzyme, it allows control of glucose level after meal consumption. And then we also look at the potential of the seaweed to inhibit anti-DPP4 activity. Now, DPP4 stands for dipeptidylpeptidase 4, which is responsible for the degradation of incretin hormones. Now, incretins are gastrointestinal hormones which stimulate the decrease in blood glucose levels and causing increase in the amount of insulin secreted after meals. Therefore, by definition, these incretin hormones are insulinotropic, meaning they induce insulin secretion. So if we can inhibit DPP4 activity, we boost the activity of incretins, which will stimulate insulin production. So we study different seaweed species for their potential in inhibiting the alpha-glucosidase enzyme, the DPP4, and also in stimulating incretin production.
There are two types of diabetes, as you mentioned earlier, type 1 as well as type 2. Do these compounds help against both diabetes types?
That's a very good question. What we have to bear in mind is that in both types of diabetes, the primary objective of diabetes management is to ensure sufficient delivery of glucose to various tissues of the body and also to delay and or prevent the complications related to the disease due to hyperglycemia. And this is done by achieving good glycemic control. Hence, I believe our work on the utilization of seaweed for managing glycemia can potentially assist against both types of diabetes. And of course, this is still at an early stage of study and more work is needed in the future.
Going back to the actual isolation of these compounds, how did you screen for them to begin with in these particular types of seaweed?
Well, in general, we conducted water extraction process involving the selected seaweed species, and then the water extract was subsequently subjected to a series of tests. As I mentioned before, we look at the three different parameters for antidiabetic activity. So we screen this seaweed water extract for their effects on alpha-glucosidase inhibition, DPP4 inhibition, and also the production of incretin hormones. Each of these antidiabetic properties of the different seaweed species were evaluated to generate a profile for each of the species that we studied. So once we have that screening data, we subjected the promising candidates for further separation and identification studies using techniques including HPLC and GCMS before re-evaluating the antidiabetic properties of the identified compounds using the previously mentioned antidiabetic parameters.
When it comes to scientific and medical research in the oceans, do you go in with a specific goal in mind, something that you're looking for, or is it more screening through what's available and looking at the potential possibilities? Because, for example, with this piece of research, was the intention to look for anti-diabetic medications, or was it a pleasant byproduct, so to speak?
For this particular study, we specifically look for antidiabetic potential of seaweed. So we know a set of seaweed species, especially Malaysian seaweed species, to screen for the antidiabetic activity.
What do you think of the medical potentials of other algae species?
I think seaweeds or microalgae as well as microalgae have various medical potentials, and these remain to be explored, and not just for antidiabetics. They may also have other medically beneficial properties such as anti-cancer, antioxidant and others. Now, each species have their own special qualities in terms of biochemical constituents and secondary metabolites produced, which warrants further scientific exploration.
What are the prospects, in your opinion, of finding more pharmaceutical compounds in our marine ecosystem, speaking broadly?
Okay, so, well, the prospect is enormous, especially considering that the vast majority of the ocean remain unexplored. Many new species are waiting to be discovered, and numerous applications of novel bioactive compounds from known marine species also waiting to be elucidated. And I think that evolution is the best designer of compounds for biomedical applications, and the challenge now is to actually find them. So basically, the ocean is our oyster, and I believe there are many potential beneficial bioactives from our marine ecosystem which remain to be discovered.
Thank you, Dr. Yusrizam. I've been speaking to Dr. Yusrizam Sharifuddin from the Institute of Biological Sciences at the Science Faculty of University Malaya, discussing anti-diabetic function that's been found in compounds from seaweeds on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture's World Oceans Day Health Special. We're looking at Malaysian research today into the potential of what the oceans could hold in terms of medicine and life-saving drugs. Now, we turn our attention to a powerful antioxidant that may also have other protective benefits for our health, astaxanthin. Professor Pang Siew Moy from the Institute of Ocean and Earth Sciences in University Malaya discusses her research. Professor Pang, what do we know for sure are the benefits of antioxidants in our bodies?
As the name suggests, antioxidants are actually compounds that protect our systems against these compounds which are known as oxidants. These oxidants are actually in the form of what they call free radicals. They are like super oxygen molecules. Well, they're naturally produced during normal metabolism. But when one is stressed, there is an increased production of these oxidants. So the antioxidants, yeah. And most of these antioxidants are actually carotenoids from natural sources such as microalgae and plants and so on. So what these antioxidants do is they actually neutralize and remove these free oxygen species from the bloodstream and prevent damage to the system.
There's been much discussion over finding a stable antioxidant for consumption. What does that mean from a biochemical point of view?
You see, most of these antioxidants are natural compounds produced by microbes, by plants, and even animals. And when you actually extract it out from the their natural environment, they would be vulnerable or sensitive to damage by different set of environmental conditions. Like, for example, temperature may be different from the temperature existing in the natural condition. pH may be different. Different ions may also be present in the environment. And all this would actually either cause damage or reduce the effectiveness of these antioxidants. Some of these antioxidants, like astaxanthin, they are quite stable, and studies have shown that under specific conditions, like maybe low pH, pH around 4, storage in low temperatures, or even having them protected through encapsulation, in capsules, can actually enhance their stability.
So you mentioned astaxanthin there. What exactly is it?
Well, astaxanthin is actually a pigment. This pigment is sort of orange to red in color, and it is a member of a family of pigments known as the carotenoids. These carotenoids are actually it's actually one of the biggest group of natural pigments. In fact, there are about 600 different carotenoids already identified in microorganisms like the algae, bacteria, even in some plants and animals. And in fact, there is a very big market for carotenoids, over US $900 million.
What are the sources of astaxanthin?
Astaxanthin is actually commercially produced from a fungus known as Fafia. But in recent years, it's being produced from a microalgae called a Haematococcus. So this is a green unicellular microscopic alga, and it's being mass cultivated, and the astaxanthin is actually extracted from this algae.
How was it discovered?
Well, it was discovered in the 1972 to be exact, by this scientist known as Professor Basil Whedon from England. He actually had this astaxanthin isolated from the Scottish salmon, and he named it astaxanthin. Asta meaning crab in Greek, and xanthin is supposed to be an old Greek word for blonde edges or blonde leaves. Yeah.
And so you mentioned the microalgae. What is the process of isolating astaxanthin?
Now, if we look at the Haematococcus, which is the species which is commercially cultivated for production of astaxanthin, the Haematococcus actually, it produces what they call a resting spore in its old age, right? This resting spore, sporangia, is produced after the cells have been cultured for, you know, more than a week or so. And in this condition, the cells actually would have undergone stress, because then nutrients have become limited and so on. And during this stress period, the cells start to produce, overproduce, and they start to accumulate the astaxanthin. So these spores are then harvested, and the cells have to be ruptured to release the pigment, to release the astaxanthin. And very often the astaxanthin can be extracted, you know, with the use of solvents, because it is actually fat soluble. So it can be extracted out using different kinds of solvents. And after it's extracted out, it can be then stored in oil or, you know, other forms of lipids.
How would astaxanthin function within our bodies? What benefits might it bring?
Basically, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it is an antioxidant. And very often, many of the, you know, our health disorders are actually related to the effect of antioxidants. And these antioxidants actually are increased in our systems during times of stress as well. So with the use of antioxidants like astaxanthin, what we call the reactive oxygen species, which are produced during stress, yeah, are actually sort of removed by the antioxidant activity of the astaxanthin, and resulting in, you know, reduced damage to our cells, to our tissues, to our organs. Now, there have been many studies that report other effects of astaxanthin in addition to the antioxidant properties. Things like anti-lipid peroxidation. Now, the cell membrane is actually made up of lipids. And of course, if the cell membrane is damaged, then of course the cell function is also will be compromised. So it is believed that, you know, if you take supplements containing antioxidants like astaxanthin, it can actually prevent damage to cell membranes, which is associated with many kinds of diseases. Then another example is the anti-inflammation property of astaxanthin. So again, you know, inflammation is also due to, you know, oxidative stress. They're all related. So it is basically all related to the antioxidant property. Studies also show anti-cancer properties. Even astaxanthin has been reported to be effective against atherosclerotic cardiovascular diseases, you know, heart diseases. But of course, these are all reports from scientific studies.
How does it compare to other antioxidants such as vitamin C?
Vitamin C is of course also a natural antioxidant, and it is the one I think most commonly taken as a health supplement. Now, studies have shown that astaxanthin is actually, you know, 65 times more potent than you know, vitamin C, 54 times more potent than beta-carotene, and more than 500 times more potent than vitamin E. So it seems to be a more effective antioxidant compared to the currently used antioxidant.
And how does it help to fight fatigue or why is it good for people who exercise often and athletes?
You know, I think it's again related to the antioxidant effects, but it's supposed to be good for recovery of muscles. It's supposed to, you know, enhance your endurance, you know, enhance strength, improve energy levels. But I think basically it's all involved with the antioxidant properties, the anti-inflammation properties, yeah, and so on.
What differences might synthetic astaxanthin have compared to its organic version?
Well, the natural astaxanthin actually occurs in what you call the esteric form of this pigment. So it actually exists as an ester, yeah, which is a chemical form. Whereas synthetic astaxanthin exists in what you call a free form. And the results, you know, from studies have shown that the natural esterified form of astaxanthin has a better biological function, yeah, and properties. And it's also, of course, I think, more stable.
What further discoveries may yet be found in microalgae?
Well, the microalgae, there's actually a great diversity of microalgal species. Both, you know, they exist both in freshwater and in the marine environment. And we are only now, you know, discovering, you know, this wide range of useful compounds from microalgae. And of course, many people are actually focusing on bioactive compounds from microalgae because, you know, of course, we would like to look for cures for cancer, for, you know, AIDS, and so on. And so most of the research have focused on bioactive compounds, which can be developed into biopharmaceuticals. But there are the microalgae actually can perform, you know, many other functions, can provide biochemicals for many other products. A very good example is biofuel. Now, because of, you know, global warming, due to the increased emissions of carbon into the environment, people are actually looking for alternative biofuels, especially renewable biofuels. And the microalgae actually can produce very high lipids. And if these lipids actually contain the suitable fatty acids, which can be converted into diesel, then these, you know, algal oils can actually provide a sustainable source of renewable energy. And most of this biodiesel, which can be produced from algal lipids, can actually be used for transport needs. Yeah.
And finally, what are your hopes and fears when it comes to the future of bioprospecting from our oceans?
Well, I think the oceans, you know, really are the next frontier for discovery of novel compounds, not only from the microalgae, but, you know, from bacteria, invertebrates. I think one reason is because the oceans, yeah, actually provide very stressed environments for these microbes and the living resources. And under stress environments, many of these microbes would then, you know, be stimulated to produce very interesting compounds to overcome the stress. And these compounds, yeah, actually are associated with bioactivity. So these compounds can be actually lead compounds or sources of, you know, biopharmaceuticals, medicines, drugs, you know, for humans as well. And for example, in the deep sea trenches, this is where stress environments are found. And people have actually discovered microbes living in these stress environments. And these microbes actually contain a very interesting novel compounds which have been found to have antimicrobial, antibacterial, antiviral activities. But of course, to be able to go and, you know, search out these microbes from deep sea trenches, you would need to have suitable equipment, maybe unmanned submersibles, robotic systems that can go and collect samples and even do isolation on board of these, you know, submersibles. So it's actually a very interesting era for us, you know, with the invention of, you know, this type of submersibles.
That was Professor Pang Siew Moy from the Institute of Ocean and Earth Sciences in University of Malaya discussing astaxanthin. One theme that ran through all our interviews today was the importance of preserving the ocean and its biodiversity, or we could run the risk of losing precious compounds that could enrich and save human lives.
One of the issues is that all those pollutions and all the disruptions to the marine ecosystem might actually kill some of the organisms before we even have the chance to go and work on them and check out whether they have, you know, useful therapeutic agents, compounds. And another issue probably would be when it gets polluted and some of the marine organisms start dying or start getting depleted, it might actually limit the supply, okay, of all these bioresources that we can work on. If, for example, we find that there is a certain compound that can be isolated from a certain marine species and we need a lot of them to isolate enough compounds, and in the case where it is somehow not possible to synthesize it in the lab, then we will be stuck. So yes, there is really big negative effects on the bioprospecting research.
Because, you know, the environment, we are now living in a changing environment. We have climate change, we have global warming, which is associated with ocean acidification. You know, pollution is increasing, you know, in our coastal waters, in the oceanic waters. And all these actually are threat to the biodiversity in our oceans. So if we do not act fast enough, we may actually lose many of these valuable species which contain very important compounds which have yet to be discovered.
Whatever harm we inflict upon our environment will eventually affect us. So we will ultimately reap what we sow, and damaging our ocean is no exception. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So marine ecosystems are both rich and fragile. Hence, the repercussions of polluting the ocean will not only affect the valorization of marine bioresources, but ultimately the climate. So it is a very slippery slope, and these changes, I believe, will reduce our chances of discovering novel marine bioactive compounds in the future.
You've been listening to our World Oceans Day special on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.